Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. We're the podcast where we dig into a whole stack of sources to pull out the key insights, helping you get informed fast. Today, we are diving deep into Rutherford B. Hayes, the 19th president of the United States. Now, look, his name might not ring a bell quite like Lincoln or Roosevelt, but as we explore these sources we've gathered, you'll find a leader whose life was packed with, well, drama, dedication, and some genuinely unexpected twists.
Absolutely. And what's really fascinating about Hayes, I think, is how much of the real story gets lost. You know, the nuances of who he was, the actual impact of his policies, it often just gets boiled down to a historical footnote. So our mission today is to push past that superficial stuff. We want to really delve into the details, his incredible bravery in the Civil War, his commitment to reform, even some really surprising ideas he had after his presidency. We're aiming to give you a truly well-rounded perspective on him and, you know, the whole turbulent era he navigated.
And we have found some real gems in these sources for you, things that'll definitely make you lean in. Like a presidential election, so contested it nearly tore the country apart, earned him the nickname his fraudulency, right? We'll also unpack his Civil War record marked by incredible bravery and, get this, 5 combat wounds. Plus, you'll hear about his, well, frankly surprising views on wealth inequality, even flirting with socialist ideas later in life. And a little historical first. He was the first president ever to take the oath of office privately, right inside the White House. Hayes' story left a significant mark, maybe an underappreciated one, on American history. And we're here to figure out why. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Our sources paint this picture of Hayes' childhood, and it's really shaped by both loss and a lot of family support. He was born October 4th, 1822, in Delaware, Ohio. And wow, his father died just 10 weeks before he was born. Imagine that. So he was raised by his mother, Sophia Burchard, and his sister, Fanny. But there was another key figure, his uncle, Sardis Burchard. He really stepped in, became like a father figure. And Sardis didn't just offer emotional support. He actually helped fund Hayes' early education, even lived with the family for a while. You really have to wonder how facing that kind of loss so early, but then having this strong family net, especially his uncle, how that forged his character, you know, his resilience.
Oh, absolutely. That early period, it's often where you see the seeds of leadership being planted, isn't it? And it does raise that question. How much of his later belief in, say, meritocracy, self-reliance, his focus on principles, how much of that came from this specific upbringing? Dealing with loss, but also having that strong guidance, especially intellectually from his uncle, it probably instilled a deep sense of responsibility, a drive to prove himself. It really speaks to the power of family, community, in shaping someone, particularly back then without the modern safety nets.
And his education definitely built on that. It was pretty rigorous for the time. He started at Norwalk Seminary, then went off to Webb School in Connecticut, studied Latin, ancient Greek, the classics. So this wasn't just, you know, basic schooling. It was building a serious intellectual foundation. Then he went to Kenyon College, 1838 to 42, really shone there, graduated Phi Beta Kappa, valedictorian, and he was already getting interested in politics, specifically Whig politics, you know, the party focus on economic development, moral reform. That intellectual drive then took him to Harvard Law School, graduated with an LLB in 1843, got admitted to the Ohio Bar in 45, opened his own law office in Lower Sandusky, which is now Fremont. But those first years, they were a struggle. Business was slow. He even got sick. They thought it might be tuberculosis and had to travel. Sounds like those classic early career challenges, right? Something a lot of us can probably relate to.
Definitely. And that mix of struggle alongside such a deep classical education, it likely created a really unique blend in him, fortitude, but also intellectual depth. It suggests someone who wasn't afraid of hard work, wasn't afraid to pivot if needed. Those early hurdles weren't just roadblocks, they were shaping experiences, building the perseverance he'd need later on. It wasn't just about knowing things, it was about developing that critical mind, that resilience that would be tested again and again.
Okay, so after those initial struggles, Hayes makes a big move in 1850, heads to Cincinnati. And Cincinnati seems to have been a real turning point for him. It was bustling, right? Found better business opportunities there, enjoyed the social life, joined literary clubs, that sort of thing. And critically, it's where he met and married Lucy Ware Webb, December 30th, 1852. Now, Lucy, she sounds like quite the force. devout Methodist, a committed teetotaler, and a really staunch abolitionist. Our sources make it clear her strong beliefs had a huge influence on Hayes, especially on temperance, and crucially, on slavery. It seems like it was a marriage that really shaped his moral framework, his public positions. They started their family there too, had several kids, though sadly, like many back then, they lost two sons in infancy. Professionally in Cincinnati, Hayes really started making a name for himself as a criminal defense attorney, took on some tough murder cases, even used an insanity defense successfully once, saved a woman from the gallows. But maybe the defining part of his legal work then, and a real sign of his convictions, was defending refugee slaves under the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. For Hayes, who was becoming a committed abolitionist, this wasn't just a job. It was deeply personal and politically useful, too, right? It boosted his profile within the brand new Republican Party. It showed where he stood. He wasn't just some lawyer. He was actively fighting against this really divisive, unjust law.
Absolutely. That work, defending fugitive slaves, especially in a place like Cincinnati, a border city, it was a direct confrontation with the biggest issue tearing the country apart. It just underscores how personal values can really drive public action, can't they? And this commitment to abolition, to civil rights, it becomes this thread, sometimes a complicated one, running through his whole career. His success in those cases didn't just build his reputation. It cemented his identity within the Republican Party early on, showed he was serious about their anti-slavery platform.
Now, as the country is barreling towards the Civil War, you'd think someone like Hayes, abolitionist, rising Republican, would be eager to fight from the get-go. But the sources show a bit more complexity there. Initially, he was described as lukewarm about war, even suggested just letting the South secede, let them go. It shows maybe a practical side, or perhaps just a reluctance to embrace something so catastrophic before it truly hit home. And interestingly, this hesitation happened around the same time he lost his job as city solicitor in Cincinnati. City politics were shifting against the Republicans, but that reluctance vanished pretty quickly after Fort Sumter, that pivotal moment. Hayes resolved his doubts, joined a volunteer company with friends from his literary society, made that leap from lawyer to soldier. So it wasn't just a gut reaction. It seems like a considered choice when faced with the absolute crisis of the Union dissolving. A transformation many leaders went through.
Right. That initial ambivalence makes his later commitment even more striking, doesn't it? It shows that even future heroes had to wrestle with the sheer scale of the conflict. His decision after Sumter was a clear turning point. And the military experience he gained, it wasn't just about battles. It was about leadership under fire, understanding logistics, the human cost, all things that would deeply inform his politics later.
And his military career.
Mm-hmm.
It was, frankly, extraordinary. June 1861, he's appointed major in the 23rd Ohio Volunteer Infantry. And who else joins that regiment as a private? Future President William McKinley. Small world, huh? Hayes moved up the ranks, fast lieutenant colonel, then colonel. But what really stands out is his reputation for just sheer bravery. The sources emphasize he was wounded 5 separate times during the war.
5 times. That's just remarkable. It speaks volumes about his leadership style. He was clearly right there in the action. And, you know, Ulysses S. Grant, who was a pretty good judge of military ability, had high praise for him. Grant said Hayes' conduct showed conspicuous gallantry, but also qualities of a higher order than that of mere personal daring. So it wasn't just being fearless, it was about competence, about command under extreme pressure. That whole experience absolutely shaped his public image and likely hardened his resolve for tackling the tough national issues he'd face later as president.
It's just incredible stuff. Think about this. Battle of South Mountain, September 1862. Hayes leads a charge against entrenched Confederates. He gets shot through his left arm, fractures the bone. Does he fall back? No. He gets someone to tie a handkerchief above the wound to try and stop the bleeding, and he keeps leading his men. Only later is he taken to a hospital. That's just an unbelievable level of determination. Leadership under fire. He fought in so many key battles. Carnifex Ferry, the 1864 Valley Campaigns, 3rd Winchester, Fisher's Hill, Cedar Creek. He even got hit in the head by spent round at Cedar Creek. By October 64, his bravery gets him promoted to Brigadier General, then breveted Major General. This guy was no armchair general. He was in the thick of it. And that war record. It became a huge part of who people saw him to be. Okay, so after becoming this celebrated war hero, Hayes' path back into politics was pretty much paved.
Wow.
While he's still serving in the Army in 1864, the Republicans back in Ohio nominate him for the U.S. House. And his reaction when they told him to come home and campaign, it's famous. He flat out refused.
Said something like, an officer fit for duty who at this crisis would abandon his post to electioneer ought to be scalped. Pretty strong words. Shows a sense of duty, right? Over personal ambition. And, incredibly, he won anyway. By a good margin, so he gets sworn into Congress in December 1865, joins a big Republican majority. Now, he considered himself more of a moderate Republican, but the sources show he often voted with the radicals, especially on Reconstruction issues, for party unity. He strongly believed the South needed strict requirements for readmission, especially protecting the rights of freedmen. That put him directly against President Andrew Johnson's more lenient plans. Hayes backed things like the 14th Amendment, the Civil Rights Act of 1866. He even voted for the first impeachment inquiry against Johnson, and even back then, he was already pushing for civil service reform, though unsuccessfully at that point. You see this pattern emerging early, right? Fighting for civil rights, pushing back against what he saw as presidential overreach, even from his own party's president.
Exactly. And that consistent stance on rights for Black Americans, plus his ability to win elections repeatedly in a key state like Ohio, that really put him on the national map. This whole period, it's like the bridge connecting his military heroism to his later presidential run. It shows his political skill, his broad appeal, his willingness to stand on principle even when it wasn't easy, suggests it was more than just political calculation. It seems deeply held.
And his political rise just kept going. Led him to become governor of Ohio not once, but three times, first elected in 1867. And get this, he campaigned hard for Black male suffrage, even though the state amendment actually failed that year. He still won, but narrowly. His first term was tough Democratic legislature, no veto power. But he still managed to get things done, like establishing schools for the deaf and a reform school for girls. Showed his interest in social welfare. Then he gets reelected in 1869 with a bigger majority in a Republican legislature. That allowed him to secure Ohio's ratification of the 15th Amendment, guaranteeing Black men the right to vote. His second term saw more progress. Expanded suffrage, setting up the State Agricultural and Mechanical College, which of course became Ohio State University, plus pushing for tax cuts and prison reform. He actually retired briefly in 1872, turned down a Senate run, wanted to keep party unity, spend time with his family, but politics pulled him back. In 1875, he accepted the Republican nomination for governor again. Now, this campaign had some controversy. Our sources mentioned he campaigned against state aid to Catholic schools, and that apparently fueled some anti-Catholic sentiment. Despite that, he won a third term. And in that term, he kept focusing on reform, cutting the state debt, reestablishing the Board of Charities. His consistent success as governor, especially winning three times in Ohio, a major swing state, it absolutely cemented his reputation, set the stage for the presidency. Okay, so Hayes's wins in Ohio made him a major player on the national scene, a serious contender for the Republican presidential nomination in 1876. James G. Blaine, he was the big name, the front runner, but he couldn't quite lock down the majority. So on the seventh ballot, the convention turns to Hayes. Kind of a compromise candidate, maybe? And for VP, they pick William A. Wheeler from New York. Hayes famously said, I am ashamed to say, who is Wheeler? Which is pretty funny. Shows how these things can happen. The campaign strategy for Hayes was interesting. They took a conciliatory approach, trying to appeal to Southern white voters, former Whigs. Signaled a bit of a shift, maybe, away from solely focusing on protecting Black civil rights in the South. He talked about needing to get along without the vote of the Black man, which is quite a statement. His opponent was Samuel J. Tilden, the Democratic governor of New York. Tilden also had a reputation for honesty, supported civil service reform, but the economy was tough. The panic of 1873 was still hurting people, making the incumbent Republicans unpopular. So the campaign was fierce, focused on swing states, and critically, those three southern states still under Reconstruction rule, Louisiana, South Carolina, Florida. There was violence, voter suppression, a real mess. Republicans pointed to the Democrats of the Civil War. Democrats pointed to Grant administration corruption.
Yeah, this election really pushed the country to the brink. You had two reform-minded candidates, technically. But against this backdrop of economic pain and these still raw wounds from the Civil War, it was just an incredibly volatile mix. And that shift in Hayes' campaign, the outreach to the South, it shows the intense political pragmatism involved, maybe even at the expense of earlier principles. It really highlights the messy moral and political realities of that post-Reconstruction moment.
And then election night, November 7th, 1876. It just descends into chaos. Tilden wins the popular vote. Looks like he has 184 electoral votes, just one short of the majority needed. Hayes has 166. But then 20 electoral votes become disputed. 19 from those three southern states, Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina, plus one from Oregon. Both sides were accusing the other of fraud, and frankly, both sides were probably right to some extent. The results were just completely uncertain. Utter chaos. Threw the whole election up in the air. There was no clear constitutional mechanism to solve this. So Congress and President Grant eventually agreed to create a special electoral commission in January 1877. Bipartisan, five representatives, five senators, five Supreme Court justices. Now, the crucial 15th member was supposed to be Justice David Davis. He was seen as independent. But then, in a crazy twist, Democrats in the Illinois legislature elected Davis to the U.S. Senate, pulled him right off the commission, which meant a Republican Justice Joseph P. Bradley ended up being the tiebreaker. The commission meets in February, and bam, an 8-7 party line vote. All 20 disputed votes go to Hayes, just like that.
It's one of those huge what-if moments, isn't it? One Senate election in Illinois potentially deciding the presidency?
Absolutely. And while that decision, you know, technically resolved the immediate crisis, it begs that huge question. What was the real cost, especially the cost of the compromise that followed? What did it mean for African Americans in the South?
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying D.C. politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
This is such a pivotal moment. It reshaped the South for generations. Connecting it to the bigger picture, it just lays bare that complex tension between political necessity, maybe, and moral compromise in American government. The decision avoided immediate breakdown, sure, but it paved the way for decades of disenfranchisement and segregation, a truly heavy legacy.
Yeah, the Democratic response was fury. Total outrage. They tried to filibuster in Congress, block the commission's results, potentially stop the inauguration. So to avoid plunging the country deeper into crisis, Republican and Democratic leaders huddled up, met at the Wormley's Hotel in Washington, negotiated a deal. Basically, the Republicans made promises in exchange for the Democrats letting Hayes become president. The biggest promise. Hayes agreed he would withdraw the remaining federal troops from the South. He'd accept the newly elected Democratic state governments there. The Democrats took the deal. The filibuster ended March 2, 1877. Hayes was officially declared the winner, 185 electoral votes to 184. And with that, Reconstruction was effectively over, leaving black Southerners largely unprotected as white Democrats consolidated power and rolled back rights. Now, because March 4th, the traditional inauguration day, was a Sunday in 1877, Hayes actually took the oath privately the day before, Saturday, March 3rd, did it in the Red Room of the White House, makes him the first president ever sworn in inside the executive mansion. Kind of a quiet, almost secretive start to a presidency born in controversy.
He then had the public inauguration on Monday, March 5th. In his address, he tried to calm things down, pledged wise, honest, and peaceful local self-government for the South, talked up civil service reform, returning to the gold standard, famously said he serves his party best who serves his country best. But despite the words, many Democrats just never saw him as legitimate. Stuck him with those nicknames, Rutherfraud, his fraudulency. It really makes you think, doesn't it? How deep the divisions can run when people question the very legitimacy of their leader, and what a huge challenge it is to try and heal that. So, Hayes takes office, and despite his past support for Reconstruction, his first major act is essentially to end it, to bring about that home rule in the South. Now, it wasn't just the Wormley's Hotel deal, though that was part of it. He was under massive pressure. The Democratic House was refusing to fund the army garrisons needed in the South, and even within the Republican Party, support for military reconstruction was fading. There was ongoing violence and insurgency in the South, making it seem unsustainable to many.
When he came in, only South Carolina and Louisiana still had Republican governments backed by federal troops. In April 77, Hayes orders the troops out of both states, and without those troops there to enforce voting rights, the Republican governments just collapsed. Fell to Democratic control almost immediately. Now, Hayes did try later to find ways to protect black Southerners' rights, but those efforts didn't really amount to much. He did, however, put up a real fight against Congress when they tried to weaken federal election oversight. Democrats kept trying to attach riders to army funding bills, riders designed to repeal the Enforcement Acts. Those are the laws used against the KKK and others suppressing black votes. Hayes vetoed those bills 5 times. He was determined to keep those laws on the books. Congress finally passed the funding without the rider, but then they just refused to allocate money for the federal marshals needed to actually enforce the laws. So, kind of a hollow victory. It's a diary entry from Hayes around this time. It's really striking. He wrote, "My task was to wipe out the color line, to abolish sectionalism, to end the war and bring peace. Noble goals, maybe. But the actual result, the end of Reconstruction, had devastating consequences for millions of African Americans. Paved the way for Jim Crow."
It's such a critical juncture. Hayes's actions here, regardless of the pressures or his intentions, undeniably mark the end of a crucial era. And the consequences, as you said, were the rollback of rights and nearly a century of legalized segregation and oppression. It forces you to ask, was this pragmatic leadership necessary to hold the Union together after the disputed election? Or was it a fundamental failure to uphold the promises of emancipation and citizenship? It really starkly illustrates how political deals, even those aimed at peace or stability, can have these incredibly profound and damaging long-term social costs.
Right. Okay, so beyond that massive issue of ending Reconstruction, Hayes came into office really determined to reform the government itself, to dismantle the spoils system. He wanted federal jobs awarded based on merit, through exams, not just handed out as political favors, which was a pretty radical idea back then. And this put him immediately on a collision course with a powerful faction in his own party, the Stalwarts. They loved the spoils system. Their leader was the very influential Senator Roscoe Conkling of New York. Conkling fought Hayes on reform every step of the way. Hayes appointed Carl Schurz, a big reformer, as Secretary of the Interior, and he ordered an investigation into the New York Custom House that was like Conkling's personal patronage machine. The report found that maybe 20% of the jobs there were just political hires, totally unnecessary. Hayes couldn't get Congress to outlaw the system, but he issued an executive order, forbade federal employees from being forced to make campaign donations or do party work. Now, Chester A. Arthur, yes, the future president, was the collector of the Port of New York, a big Conkling ally. He basically refused to comply. Hayes demanded his resignation. Arthur refused, so Hayes fired him. During a congressional recess in July 1878, it was a huge fight. Conkling battled him in the Senate over the replacements. But Hayes eventually won, getting his reformist candidates confirmed. Firing Arthur and cleaning up the Custom House, that was seen as a major victory for civil service reform. And Hayes's constant pushing on this, it really laid the groundwork for the Pendleton Act, the law that finally created the professional civil service, ironically signed by Chester Arthur himself after Garfield's assassination. It just shows Hayes's determination, right? Taking on powerful figures in his own party for a principle he believed in.
It really does. And this fight wasn't just about shuffling jobs around. It was a fundamental battle over the integrity of government. Was it going to be run by political machines or by professional standards? Hayes's persistence, even though he didn't get the full legislative victory himself, created that essential momentum. It set a crucial precedent, started shifting the whole culture of government work, and had effects that lasted for generations, really changed how the bureaucracy functioned.
Then, just months into his presidency, Hayes gets hit with another crisis, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. This was the biggest labor uprising the country had ever seen up to that point. Started because railroads cut wages again after the Panic of 1873. Began with B&O workers, but spread like wildfire across major rail lines. Thousands walked off the job. Riots broke out. Governors started calling for federal help. Hayes was initially reluctant, but as things escalated, he sent in federal troops, mostly, he said, to protect federal property. But this was historic and controversial. The first time U.S. Army troops were used to intervene in a strike against a private company, to essentially break the strike. The violence eventually ended by late July. People died in clashes between strikers and state militias. Interestingly, public opinion seemed to largely blame the railroads, not the strikers. It actually forced companies to improve conditions somewhat. And Hayes's own thoughts on it, recorded in his diary, are really revealing. He wrote something like, "The strikes have been put down by force, but now for the real remedy." He wondered, can't something be done by education of strikers, by judicious control of capitalists, by wise general policy? He even called the strikers generally good men. Sober, intelligent, and industrious. Shows a surprising amount of empathy, right? A recognition of the deeper issues at play. That constant tension between labor, capital, and government power, it's a theme that just keeps coming back. Okay, beyond the strike, Hayes also had to deal with these really tricky economic issues, especially around currency. What kind of money should the country use? Two big fights. Silver coinage, and what to do about greenbacks. See, the Coinage Act of 1873, sometimes called the Crime of 73, had stopped the minting of silver dollars. Put the U.S. firmly on the gold standard. This shrank the money supply, which made the Panic of 1873 worse, especially for people in debt, farmers, laborers. They wanted silver back. They wanted more money circulating, believed it would raise wages, property values. So Congress passes a bill, the Bland-Allison Act of 1878, to bring back silver coinage, requiring the Treasury to mint millions in silver dollars each month. Hayes hated the idea. He thought it was inflationary, basically dishonest because it would devalue debts contracted under the gold standard. He vetoed it, said expediency and justice both demand an honest currency. But Congress overrode his veto. It was the only time his veto was overridden during his entire presidency. This whole fight, gold versus silver, it wasn't just technical. It was about who held economic power, whose debts got easier to pay, whose got harder. The other issue was greenbacks, that paper money issued during the Civil War, not backed by gold or silver. An earlier law, the Specie Payment Resumption Act of 1875, said the Treasury had to start redeeming greenbacks for gold beginning in 1879. Hayes and his Treasury Secretary, John Sherman, worked really hard to build up the government's gold reserves before that date. And when the day came in 1879, public confidence was high enough that very few people actually bothered to trade in their greenbacks for gold. They trusted the paper money again. So between the overridden silver bill and the successful resumption of specie payments, they kind of ended up with this workable compromise. The economy was slowly recovering anyway.
Right. And these debates, they might seem really dry and technical now, but they had huge impacts on everyday people, farmers, workers, businesses. Hayes's position, even being overridden on silver, it clearly shows his economic philosophy. He prioritized stability, worried about inflation. It's that classic hard money versus soft money debate. And it's a debate that in different forms we still see playing out in economic policy discussions today, isn't it? Who benefits from inflation, benefits from stable currency? These questions are perennial.
So Hayes wasn't just dealing with massive domestic stuff. He was actually pretty busy on the world stage too, asserting American interests. A lot of his focus was on Latin America. In 1878, he acted as an arbitrator in a really messy border dispute between Argentina and Paraguay, left over from the Paraguayan War. Hayes ended up awarding the disputed area, the Grand Chaco region, to Paraguay. And Paraguay was so grateful they actually renamed a city Villa Hayes and a whole administrative region Presidente Hayes after him. That's pretty remarkable international recognition. He also got very involved in the idea of a canal across Central America. Ferdinand de Lesseps, the guy who built the Suez Canal, had plans for Panama. Hayes took a very strong stance based on the Monroe Doctrine. He told Congress flat out, "The policy of this country is a canal under American control." So the U.S. cannot consent to the surrender of this control to any European power. End quote. That was a really forward-looking statement, wasn't it? Basically staked America's claim to dominance over any future canal, setting the stage for Teddy Roosevelt and the Panama Canal decades later.
It really does show him thinking strategically long-term about America's place in the hemisphere and the world. It wasn't just reacting to events, it was anticipating future geopolitical importance and firmly planting an American flag, metaphorically speaking, on that canal concept, a clear assertion of national interest.
The border with Mexico was another hot spot. There were frequent raids into Texas by groups from Mexico in the 1870s. Pretty early in his term, Hayes actually authorized the U.S. Army to cross the border, pursue these bandits into Mexico. Predictably, the Mexican president, Porfirio Diaz, protested strongly. Things got tense. Eventually, they worked out an agreement for joint pursuit, and Hayes promised not to let Mexican revolutionaries organize on U.S. soil. As the raids decreased, Hayes pulled back that order in 1880. And then there was China. This became a major foreign policy issue, tied up with domestic politics, especially immigration. An earlier treaty, the Burlingame Treaty of 1868, had allowed pretty much unrestricted immigration from China. But after the panic of 1873, anti-Chinese sentiment exploded, especially out west. Immigrants were blamed for taking jobs, lowering wages. So Congress passed a bill in 1879, the Chinese Exclusion Act, which would have basically torn up the treaty. Hayes vetoed it. His reasoning: he believed the U.S. shouldn't just unilaterally cancel treaties. It had to be done through negotiation. It was a principled stand based on international law. Earned him praise in the Northeast, but furious condemnation out west. Democrats in the House even tried to impeach him over it, though that failed. Eventually, after Hayes left office, a new treaty was negotiated, leading to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. But Hayes's veto, it really highlights that tension between domestic pressure and international obligations. Okay, shifting focus back home, let's talk about Native American policy under Hayes. He and his Interior Secretary, Carl Schurz, pushed a policy of assimilation, trying to integrate Native Americans into white culture. This involved education, trying to teach farming, and importantly, breaking up tribal lands into individual family plots. This really foreshadowed the Dawes Act of 1887. Hayes seemed to genuinely believe this approach would lead to self-sufficiency, peace between Native Americans and settlers. They also tried to reform the Bureau of Indian Affairs, cut down on the rampant corruption. But despite maybe good intentions, we now know this whole assimilationist approach, especially the Dawes Act, ended up being disastrous for Native Americans. Led to massive land loss, cultural disruption, and Hayes's term still saw significant conflict. The Nez Perce War in 1877, with Chief Joseph's famous fighting retreat. They were ultimately defeated, tragically forced onto reservations in Indian territory.
There were also uprisings involving the Bannock and the Ute tribes. One instance where Hayes maybe intervened more positively was with the Ponca tribe. There had been a mistake under Grant. They were forced off their land. Hayes appointed a commission in 1880. They ruled the Ponca could choose to go back to Nebraska or stay where they were and should get compensation. Hayes specifically urged Congress to act with justice and humanity towards the Ponca. It's just such a complex and often tragic history, isn't it? Even policies intended as reforms could have devastating outcomes. All right, let's lighten things up a bit. White House life under the Hayeses had some unique aspects. Most famously, his wife, Lucy Webb Hayes. She became known nationwide as Lemonade Lucy. Why? Because she banned alcohol from the White House completely. Apparently, their very first reception had wine, but Hayes himself was reportedly appalled by how drunk some guests got at other Washington events, so he got fully behind Lucy's strong temperance views.
No more booze served in the Hayes White House, ever. Now, critics called him cheap, but the sources say he actually spent more of his own money on lavish food and entertainment after the ban, to make up for the lack of alcohol. And this policy, it wasn't just personal, it had political benefits too. Really shored up support from Protestant ministers, helped convince prohibitionists to stick with the Republican Party. It's kind of a fun detail, right? Humanizes them. Shows how the First Family's values could shape even social customs at the highest level.
It's a great example, isn't it? How deeply held personal beliefs, especially those of a prominent First Lady like Lucy, could directly influence White House policy and even national politics. Lemonade Lucy isn't just a cute nickname. It reflects a real cultural force in alignment with a powerful social movement temperance. It makes you wonder how often we might overlook these personal dynamics when we analyze a presidency, its policies, its image.
And quickly, on judicial appointments, Hayes put two justices on the Supreme Court. First was John Marshall Harlan in 1877. Harlan became famous later for his powerful dissents in civil rights cases, like Plessy v. Ferguson. He was often a lone voice arguing for a broader interpretation of rights. The second was William Burnham Woods in 1880. He was a Southern Republican, a so-called carpetbagger, but apparently disappointed Hayes by often siding with the more conservative Southern Democratic view of the Constitution. Hayes also tried to appoint Stanley Matthews in 1881, but the Senate balked because of Matthews' ties to railroads and corporations. Matthews did get confirmed later under President Garfield, and interestingly, he went on to write some important decisions protecting minority rights, like in Yickwo v. Hopkins. So maybe Hayes' initial instinct about him was right after all. So after that incredibly intense single term, Rutherford B. Hayes did exactly what he promised. He didn't run for re-election in 1880. He was a big believer in a single presidential term, ideally 6 years, he thought. Still a debate we have today, right? He leaves office, goes back home to Spiegel Grove in Fremont, Ohio. But he didn't just disappear from public life. Not at all. He stayed very active, especially with veterans groups, like the Military Order of the Loyal Legion, became its commander-in-chief. And interestingly, even though he was a staunch Republican, he actually approved of Grover Cleveland, the Democrat, winning in 1884. Why? Because he liked Cleveland's stance on civil service reform. Shows how committed Hayes remained to that issue, putting principle above party. He also apparently took a lot of satisfaction watching the political rise of his old army buddy and protege, William McKinley, who of course would follow in his footsteps to the presidency later.
Yeah, his post-presidency really shows a man still deeply wrestling with the big issues facing the country. His continued advocacy, especially crossing party lines for something like civil service reform, it just underscores that commitment to principle we saw earlier. It wasn't just politics for him. It really challenges those easy labels we sometimes stick on historical figures. Shows a complexity, a depth of thought that went way beyond his time in the White House.
And in retirement, Hayes really threw himself into advocating for education, educational charities, federal funding for schools for all children. He genuinely seemed to believe education was the key, the way to heal the country's divisions, the way for people to lift themselves up. And he practiced what he preached. Served on the Board of Trustees for Ohio State University, the school he'd helped start as governor. He talked about the importance of both vocational training and academics. Famously wrote, "I preach the gospel of work. I believe in skilled labor as a part of education." He pushed hard for Congress to pass the Blair Bill, which would have provided federal aid for education, though it didn't pass. But his work did have direct impact. He encouraged black students to apply for scholarships from the Slater Fund, an organization he was involved with. And notably, a young W.E.B. Du Bois got one of those Slater Fund scholarships in 1892. Pretty amazing connection. Hayes also pushed for prison reform, just a broad commitment to social improvement. Okay, now strap in for this, because here's where the Hayes story takes a really unexpected turn. His post-presidency critique of wealth inequality and his, well, sympathy for socialist ideas. This really flies in the face of the typical image of a Gilded Age Republican president, doesn't it? In an 1886 speech, he said something startling. Free government cannot long endure if property is largely in a few hands and large masses of people are unable to earn homes, education, and a support in old age. I mean, that's a powerful warning about economic inequality coming from him then, and he kept thinking about it. The next year, 1887, he wrote in his diary calling the vast wealth owned or controlled by a few persons the giant evil and danger in this country. He saw how money was influencing everything, politics, courts, the press. And he directly linked that extreme wealth to extreme poverty, ignorance, vice, and wretchedness for the majority. He even suggested that maybe the answer lay in changing laws about corporations, property, inheritance, taxes. And then, even more remarkably, the sources point to his sympathy with socialism. One journal, after he died, explicitly mentioned this. Said socialism isn't necessarily revolutionary. And it credited Hayes with giving the famous writer William Dean Howells his first socialistic direction. Hayes apparently used things like the post office and public schools as examples of practical socialism. Things run for the common good. Even like Edward Bellamy's famous utopian novel, Looking Backward, which imagined a socialist future. So the 19th president, a Republican, expressing sympathy for socialism, warning about concentrated wealth as the giant evil, that is a major surprising twist to his legacy.
It's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? The foresight in those observations is really striking. His worries about concentrated wealth, its corrosive effect on democracy, they sound incredibly relevant today. It reminds you these aren't new problems. And it really forces that question, how often do we miss these deeper philosophical currents in historical figures because we just box them in by party label? Connecting it to the bigger picture, it suggests the intellectual landscape of that era was maybe more complex, more critical of capitalism's excesses than we sometimes assume. He saw the potential danger long before many others.
Hayes's final years involved continued public work, but also deep personal sadness. His wife, Lucy, died in 1889. He was devastated, wrote that the soul had left Spiegel Grove when she passed. His very last words, apparently just before he died, were, "I know that I'm going where Lucy is." Very touching. He stayed involved, though. In 1890, he chaired the Lake Mohawk Conference on the Negro question, still engaging with issues of race. Rutherford B. Hayes died on January 17, 1893. He was 70. Complications from a heart attack at home in Spiegel Grove. His funeral was attended by major figures, President-elect Grover Cleveland, Governor William McKinley, a sign of his stature. He was buried there at Spiegel Grove next to Lucy. So how do we remember him? His place in history is definitely complicated, debated. His biographer, Ari Hugenboom, argues his biggest achievement was restoring faith in the presidency itself, stopping the decline of executive power after Lincoln. Supporters point to his unwavering fight for civil service reform. But critics, and this is a heavy criticism, point to his handling of Reconstruction's end. His perceived leniency towards the South, and especially the withdrawal of federal protection for black civil rights. The consequences were just immense and long-lasting. So historians generally rank him kind of in the middle, maybe average to below average, reflecting that really mixed legacy. But despite the debates, he has been honored. The Hayes Presidential Library and Museums at Spiegel Grove, that was actually the very first presidential library in the country, opened in 1916. He's been on stamps, a dollar coin. And then there's that incredible international legacy. In Paraguay, the Presidente Hayes Department, Villa Hayes, even an official holiday commemorating his arbitration decision. So their legacy is definitely still visible, etched in places and institutions, even if it remains complex and sometimes controversial. Hashtag tag tag outro. So as we wrap up this deep dive on Rutherford B. Hayes, here's something to think about. Here's a man often remembered for how he got into office that disputed election, his fraudulency, and for overseeing the painful end of Reconstruction.
Yet in his labor years, he dedicated himself to warning about the dangers of extreme wealth concentration, even finding common ground with socialist thinking. It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? If a leader from the heart of the Gilded Age could be so insightful, so concerned about economic inequality, what does that tell us about these cycles in history? About the challenges that maybe we're still wrestling with today? What part of Hayes' journey, his contradictions, stood out most to you?
That's exactly the point, isn't it? It forces us to look past those simple narratives, the easy labels, and really grapple with the complexity of leadership, especially during times of huge national upheaval. Hayes' story is a powerful reminder of how the initial controversy surrounding a figure can sometimes overshadow the full arc of their life, their evolving ideas, their lasting impact, both positive and negative. His insights, his struggles with governance, economic fairness, racial justice, they still resonate with surprising clarity. It urges us to consider the long shadow cast by decisions made in moments of crisis and to appreciate the unexpected relevance we can find even in figures history has sometimes overlooked.
D.C. politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.